Platypus Affiliated Society was founded in Chicago in 2006 and has since become an international organization with chapters across the world. Platypus organizes reading groups, public fora like this panel, research, journalism, all focused on problems and tasks inherited from the left historically. From the old left of the 20s and 30s to the new left of the 60s and 70s and the post-political left of the 80s and 90s, ultimately for the possibility of emancipatory politics today. So at our chapter here at BC, we host reading groups every Monday at 7:30. We've changed our room, so now we're room 394 in this building. If you leave the elevator, it's right on the left, the glass fishbowl. So we have flyers at our table outside. I know some of you came in through the back, but in the front there's event flyers. And if you'd like more information on your way out, you can grab some of those. We also host coffee breaks every Friday at 3 at the cafe right outside, where we discuss current events on the left and recent issues of the Platypus Review, our monthly publication that's open for submission. So to stay notified of our ongoing events and activities like this panel, you can find us online. So if you look at the event flyer today, on the back we have the Platypus Affiliated Society homepage, the Boston page, and the chapter here on Facebook. And you can also access our PR, the Platypus Review, the monthly publication online. And we also have a bunch of physical copies here. So you may have heard our slogan, "The left is dead, long live the left." We believe that the improbably but not impossible reconstitution of an emancipatory left is an urgent task, that the future of humanity depends on it. It is our conviction that we can't understand the crisis we are in today without understanding how we got here. To that end, Platypus is the only group on campus that takes the history of the left seriously and critically. Our panel today will demonstrate the importance of hosting the conversation that otherwise would not happen. You may have read the panel description, which is in the inside of your flyers. So I won't read it out loud, but I'll say a few words introducing the event, Freedom in the Anthropocene. So the term Anthropocene developed recently as a way to periodize the era since the Industrial Revolution to today as a new geological epoch. The idea of the Anthropocene is meant to capture a change in the history of the planet, that for the first time in history, the Earth's course will be determined by the question of what humanity will become. For Enlightenment thinkers, the idea of humanity being the driver of planetary history was viewed as a great accomplishment. But recently, it's come to be associated with potential demise on Earth. So today, it seems like the idea of freedom has not survived the collapse of Marxist politics in the 20th century. We live in a world in which the fate of ecological systems seems foreclosed. For many, degradation of the environment appears as a given feature of modern society, something which can only be resisted or despaired, but not transformed. This panel will consider the issues of history and freedom, and thus capitalism and the left, and their relation to our present inability to render environmental threats visible and comprehensible, society's capacity to overcome them freely, therefore. So today's discussion will focus on different interpretations of the left's failure to lead society in dealing with the deepening crisis of planetary change, addressing such issues as the growing phenomena of climate activism, Green New Deal politics, the Extinction Rebellion, and more. So now to introduce our panelists, from left to right, we have Nafis Hassan of the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. We have Richard Rubin of Platypus, Linda Thompson of the Green Party, and Alexander Dallasera, unaffiliated. And I'm your moderator, Will Stratford. So I ask that everyone of the panelists please speak up, as we don't have a mic. I think it should be fine, the room's not too big. But still, as a moderator, I'll be looking out. So in the audience, raise your hand if you can't hear, and I'll ask them to speak up. In terms of format, each panelist will have 10 minutes to give opening remarks. So panelists, please try not to go over that so that we have plenty of time for Q&A. And I have this 2-minute sign that I'll hold up to let you know, and it's been 8 minutes. So after opening remarks, the panelists will have 2 to 3 minutes to respond to each other if they'd like. Then we'll open up for Q&A discussion. So with that, let's give a round of applause to our panelists and begin.
I'm going first. Thank you all for having me here and for the invitation. So before I begin with the question at hand, I think it should be made clear that Democratic Socialists of America, they identify as a broad tent leftist organization. There is a long range of social democrats to communist anarchists in the organization. However, what is relevant here is the DSA's eco-socialism work. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the tenets of eco-socialism, but let me just refer to it real quick. That was decided in the Belem Declaration of 2007. It was formed by a group of eco-Marxists, especially Joel Koval, Michael Lowy, and Ian Angus, who described eco-socialism to involve a revolutionary social transformation of needs by a profound shift away from quantitative and toward qualitative economic criteria, an emphasis on use value instead of exchange value. These aims require both democratic decision-making in the economic sphere, enabling society to collectively define its goals of investment and production, and the collectivization of the means of production. So why is this important? Because currently, as Will mentioned, that there's a lot of talk about Green New Deal politics, and the DSA has staked out a leftist interpretation of what the Green New Deal should look like. And the 7 guiding principles of that eco-socialist Green New Deal state to decarbonize the economy fully by 2030, democratize control over major energy systems and resources, center the working class in a just transition to an economy of societal and ecological care, decommodify survival by guaranteeing living wages, healthcare, childcare, housing, food, water, energy, public transit, a healthy environment, and other necessities for all, reinvent our communities to serve people and planet, nonprofit, demilitarize, decolonize, and strive for a future of international solidarity and cooperation. And lastly, redistribute resources from the worst polluters with just and progressive taxes on the rich, big corporations, and dirty industry, as well as by diverting funds away from policing, prisons, and our government's bloated military budget. Okay, so with that out of the way, I think what I'd like to talk about is a little bit why we are here, right? How did we end up in this place? And specifically, what the left has failed to address in decades of organizing is they have failed to recognize the environmental catastrophe that we have been barreling towards. So to begin with, I'd like to point out that, you know, historically Marx has been, Marxist philosophy has largely been used in a Promethean manner. There has been many sorts of industrialized supposed socialist governments from the Soviet Union to Cuba, Cuba is still mostly agricultural, but I'll talk a little bit about it in a little bit as to why that was an issue. What the problem is as John Bellamy Foster recognizes in Marx's Ecology, is that largely Marx's environmental work was ignored for the most part. And this isn't necessarily, you know, there was a large debate called the Dialectics of Nature debate that started in the Soviet Union and continued throughout in the Western world through the Frankfurt School under Adorno and Horkheimer, right? The idea of Dialectics of Nature was supposed to describe our man's relation to nature, and that is the central tenet of what eco-socialists or eco-Marxists try to claim. Basically, the idea is man's relation to nature exists through its labor, right? And then Engels decided to codify that by turning on Hegel's 3 laws of dialectics by describing Engels' dialectics of nature, the 3 laws. And can't really read them on top of my head, so I'm just gonna refer to my notes real quick. So the 3 laws are the law of transformation of quantity into quality and vice versa, the law of interpenetration of the opposites, and the law of negation of the negation. So these are all terminology that have been, you know, borrowed from Hegel. And while Hegel had originally used dialectics to describe movement in history and the formation of thought, Engels and Marx both applied it to the material world, because for Marx, the idea is only manifested in the material. So therefore, the material world comes first. However, as Helena Sheehan points out, the problem was with Engels' use of the vocabulary that led to so many questions. And in the end, what happened in the Soviet Union is that there were different strains of thought about what is exactly meant to be a dialectical materialist. There were folks who were idealists and there were folks who were mechanists, right? So one believed in the existence of material a priori to the idea of thought, and the other was vice versa. I'm sure you're all supposedly familiar with Lysenkoism, because, you know, if you talk about dialectics of nature or Marxist science, you cannot really talk without mentioning Lysenko. Lysenko's problem was not necessarily that he had a bad philosophy. It was a combination of factors that coincided with his meteoric rise within Stalin's administration that sort of helped him codify his own take of dialectical materialism. So what was Lysenko's problem? So many notes, sorry. Yeah, so Lysenko proposed a theory of heredity that ignored the existence of genes. For some of you who are biologists here like me, then you might understand why that is problematic. But essentially, at that time, genes was not considered to be, it was not really, given a name. It was Mendelian inheritance was considered to be true, but there was no name given to the unit of inheritance. But he did agree to...
Epigenesis, wasn't it? Epigenetics.
I think it was, you can say that Lysenko's idea was retrofitted into epigenetics, but there is a lot of issues with that, because his idea did not really, if you really look at what epigenetics is now, it's very different from what Lysenko had proposed and put into practice in the agricultural areas. Anyway, so to go back to what I was saying is that he did acknowledge the existence of chromosomes and posited that heredity was based solely on the interaction between environment and the organism. And therefore, intentional changes to the environment can direct organismal growth. And this is very key to understand, because here, what's happening is that Lysenko is proposing that the organism is essentially can be changed by the environment. And that is a violation of the dialectical law, which poses the organism, the environment, to co-dictate each other's development. So at this point, Lysenko is essentially proposing that the organism is a passive recipient of the environmental changes without actively, and the organism doesn't actively determine its own environment. So why am I saying all of this? It is essentially because, you know, when the Frankfurt School of Western Marxism encountered what was the orthodox Marxism like by Stalin's government, it was they rejected this idea that dialectical materialism can be applied to the natural world. Like, what about, as Schmidt wrote, the concept of nature cannot be separated, neither philosophy or natural sciences, from the degree of power exercised by social practice over nature at any given time. And he argued that later Marx, and this is a little important, because earlier Marx had a lot of flowery language about how man cannot survive without nature. However, later Marx did turn out to be a little bit more techno-optimistic or technocratic, however you want to put it. Marx had concluded that man will never transcend their antagonistic relationship with the environment. So why is this important? It's important because leftist governments or leftist ideology has still working on the idea that in order for development to happen, we still need to go through industrialization or rely on natural resources through a way that is extractivist in nature. And this is the barrier that we have not been able to overcome. There are pockets, there are other trends. For example, Mario Bookchin would argue against this, obviously, but I'm not very well read on Bookchin's idea, except that I do like the Rojava revolution that's going on. And more recently, in 2017, there's a paper by, I think, a Norwegian philosopher, who his name is Carl Kjærsgaard, and he said, while nature must remain a realm of necessity, it does not mean that human beings' relation to nature must be one of perennial antagonism or domination. So my training is as a biologist. I'm a developmental biologist by profession. And the reason why I'm saying that is because there is a whole separate thought of ideas in biology which has shown that organism and the environment exist in relation to each other. And it's verifiable by research. It's verified by different levels of biological organization. To give you some examples, for during fertilization, which is like the, a lot of people would say that's the premise of life. A lot of Catholics would also say that. Also very religious people. But essentially, what's happening there is the fusion of two cells. So essentially, it is hearkening back to Engels' law of dialectics, is the interpenetration of the opposites, right? And then if you think about how life grows, bacterial growth, or any sort of eukaryotic or prokaryotic growth, That obeys the law of negation of the negation, which is essentially life will continue to grow till it meets its constraints. So essentially, the dialectical worldview is the same as the naturalist worldview. And from my perspective, these two have been not been, you know, integrated, and that's why we are here at the climate crisis today. I think I'm going to stop there.
The subject I'd like to address today is not a scientific one, nor even directly a political one. It is an attempt to analyze fears, both rational and irrational, and to diagnose the obscured object of our anxiety. What I want to talk about is the social imagination of catastrophe. I shall therefore take it for granted that anthropogenic climate change is a serious problem, and that the immediate proper rational response to this problem is to cut back on the emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Leaving aside a noisy, tiny, but politically influential minority of climate deniers and skeptics, I will treat the mainstream discourse on climate change of everyone from the center to the far left, however hyperbolic its rhetoric may occasionally be, as rooted in scientific fact. I will therefore focus on the problem and focus on the responses of those who acknowledge its seriousness. I will also not address the question of exactly how urgent the problem is or how catastrophic the consequences of leaving it unaddressed or insufficiently addressed or addressing it too late are likely to be. Rather, I want to talk about is the social and political imagination that I believe lies behind the rhetorical strategies that anthropogenic climate change represents an existential challenge that is sui generis in character and must upend all our hitherto existing notions of politics. What strikes me about this is that an extremely radical rhetoric is being employed for the goal of enacting rather bland reformist politics. The world as we know it, we are told, is about to end in a few years, but that's why we need to elect Democrats who will enact the Green New Deal. There is a disconnect between the catastrophic rhetoric and the reformist mildness of the proposed solution. In fact, there are actually three quite different rhetorical strategies surrounding climate change prophecies of disaster that, although logically incompatible, are sometimes held by the same people or mixtures of these different positions. The first mainstream position is to simply assert the need for a vigorous regulatory response within the framework of both industrial civilization and capitalism. The second response, the radical environmental response, is to indict industrial civilization itself. The solution to anthropogenic climate change is, in this view, nothing less than a radical transformation of the relationship of humanity to nature. Finally, there is the socialist view, which, like the radical environmental view, accepts the need for profound systemic change, but which, unlike the radical environmentalist view, puts the blame squarely on capitalism rather than industrial civilization. To avoid ecological catastrophe, according to this last view, what we need is socialist revolution. I will from now on refer to these as the liberal, the radical, and socialist positions, with an awareness that these terms are chosen for the sake of brevity and are all problematic. For example, although the radical environmentalist position is indeed radical in the sense of going to the root or a supposed root, it is not radical in the sense of left wing. Indeed, I would argue it is fundamentally a radical right wing response rooted in a hostility to the Enlightenment, modernity, and even humanity itself. In this respect, a certain type of environmentalist thought seems to be more compatible with fascist ideology than with socialism. Marxism, however, has always based its deliberately anthropocentric vision of a liberated future in a faith in the possibility of human control over the natural world. Although I am much more sympathetic in principle to the socialist perspective, it suffers from an awkward logical flaw. If, in fact, nothing short of socialist revolution can save us from ecological catastrophe, then we're almost certainly doomed, since if the crisis posed by anthropogenic climate change is as pressing as is frequently claimed, then the prospect of socialist revolution in this time frame appears extremely dubious, except to the most deluded enthusiasts. Actually, however, most of the people who hold the socialist position will in practice also defend the idea of struggling for precisely the same reformist goals that those whom I have described as holding liberal positions advocate. Now, in fact, of course, the existence of a worldwide socialist federation and a global planned economy would in fact make the problems of anthropogenic climate change very easy to address, whereas the present capitalist world order of sovereign nation states makes the problems difficult to address precisely because of the political and social character of the world order and not because of any fundamental technical or scientific reasons. This is, in fact, the highly important rational kernel of the socialist critique of the liberal view. As long as capitalism survives, the future of humanity remains in doubt, because capitalism is, as a social system, globally irrational, even if as it perfects its instrumental rationality in limited and fractured realms. Our entire capitalist civilization is permeated, as Marxists have long recognized, by local hyper-rationalization and global irrationality. Everything can be subordinated to instrumental rationality except the whole. So far, true enough, but there's also a problem with the socialist case against reformism in that it overstates the inability of capitalism to modify itself. Although fundamentally correct at the deep structural level and as a long-term perspective, it underestimates the flexibility of both capitalism and the bourgeoisie in the short and medium term. It is simply untrue that capitalism is necessarily, as a social system, dependent on fossil fuels. A global capitalism based on nuclear or even solar energy is entirely conceivable. This is the actual point of the Green New Deal, I believe. Not socialism, but an improved capitalism is envisaged. Furthermore, environmental reforms under capitalism do work sometimes. The Cuyahoga River, which caught fire in the 70s, and the Great Lakes today are much cleaner than they were in the 1970s. All of this has happened strictly within the framework of capitalism. It is true that capitalists can make profits by coal-fired power plants, but it's also true that they can make profits by making zero-emission electric vehicles or solar panels. So what then of the framework that I've dubbed liberal? The first point I would make is that this is the only one of the three perspectives that I have outlined that I believe has any traction in the real world. Although many people will criticize either industrial society or capitalism, there is no actual threat to either posed by this rhetoric. Opposition to industrial civilization is, as Trotsky once said, of a quite different political movement, a utopia and a reactionary one at that. The entire possibility of freedom in the Anthropocene is dependent on industrial civilization, I would argue. The opposition to capitalism is also devoid of political significance in today's world, where, despite widespread discontent with capitalism, revolutionary socialism is a position held only by a tiny disorganized minority. In this respect, the liberal reformist position might seem to be both the most realistic and the most honest. Why then do so many people tend to doubt it? One answer is the cynical one that nowadays people feel the need for a radical rhetoric to push forward even the most banal liberalism. Hence, even mainstream Democrats nowadays talk about climate change as an existential threat. I believe that there is a deeper answer, however. Intuitively, the sense that climate change is an existential crisis is tied to the sense that capitalism itself is unstable and a threat to the survival of humanity. This view, which I consider fundamentally correct, is, however, mediated by two problems. The first is that industrial society is often conflated with capitalism, and a problem of the relationship of human beings to other human beings and the organization of society is thus misunderstood as one of human beings to an hypostasized nature. This leads to the radical environmentalist perspective, which is deeply anti-human. The second problem is that the alternative socialist critique, while correctly diagnosing the problem not as one of industrial society, but rather of capitalism, fails to address the historical crisis of socialist politics in the 20th century. Indeed, I would argue that the apocalyptic sense of a humanity out of balance with a natural world threatening its own survival as a species is itself a symptom of the failure of Marxism in the 20th century, in particular an impressionistic response to the deplorable environmental record of many 20th century Stalinist regimes, which suggests to many people that Marxism is itself simply another product of the mentality of industrial civilization, an ideology for the 19th century and not the 21st, different from capitalism only at the level of distribution. Marxism, this criticism goes, attacks the exploitation of human beings by other human beings, but a deeper critique of the exploitation of nature by humans is needed. Hence, there is a somewhat defensive response by socialists to attack the preface Eco as an eco-socialism or an exaggerated claims for the environmental consciousness of Marx via exegesis of obscure passages, etc. The real problem, however, is that the historical optimism of Marxism has been obscured by the profound political defeats of the last century, and with it, the vision of a free humanity using its scientific knowledge to rationally mold the material world as much as possible to human needs has come to seem a naive and hubristic delusion. Until that original socialist vision, a vision of ultimate human freedom, can be recovered by millions of people as a felt actual possibility, the truth of the socialist perspective will remain a dead letter and seem intuitively less plausible to most people than either the liberal critique, which seems simply realistic and taking for granted the permanence and immutability of capitalism, or the radical environmentalist critique, which in its romanticism seems to understand the problem as one of a deeper spiritual malaise, a view which, while reactionary in its diagnosis by pointing to our relationship to nature rather than our relationship to capitalism, nevertheless contains a profound truth, as indeed does much reactionary thought. Finally, the Pollyannish notion that the environmental crisis could be the catalyst for a renewed awareness of the need for socialism strikes me as deeply flawed. Indeed, insofar as the worst predictions of the consequences of climate change come true, massive refugee crises, for example, the probable political outcome seems to me a strengthening of the right, not the left. So what are we left with? The first point is that we must hope that the bourgeoisie is collectively rational. We should not wish for catastrophe as a catalyst for a hoped-for transformation of the world. If catastrophe comes, the left will almost certainly perish too. The second point is that catastrophe probably will come eventually in one form or another. One of the dangers of a certain alarmism is that by exaggerating the immediacy of catastrophe, it can numb people into a forgetfulness of the long-term threat. If catastrophe does come, however, it will do so not because the bourgeoisie are evil or crazy, but because ultimately the bourgeoisie is as little in control of capitalism as everyone else. The history of the world in the 20th century suggests that humanity has paid a terrible price for its delay in abolishing capitalism. A failure to do so in the 20th century might indeed lead to the death of our species. Some of us will be old enough to remember when the doomsday scenario to be feared was not global warming, but rather nuclear winter, a blocking of the sun's light by the debris sent into the atmosphere by nuclear war, rather than by a trapping of warmth by greenhouse gases. Like the threat posed by greenhouse gases, nuclear weapons are an uncomfortable reminder that scientific and technological development, detached from a rational society based on the satisfaction of human needs, is a profound threat to civilization and even humanity itself. Although the fear of nuclear war has receded since the West's bloodless victory in the Cold War a generation ago, the actual threat of the use of nuclear weapons, so far used only twice to intentionally kill human beings some three quarters of a century ago, may be greater now than ever before. Although global warming has displaced it as the catastrophic anxiety du jour, I, for one, remain more frightened by nuclear weapons, and I fear that this decade of the 2020s may once again see their use. I strongly hope that I'm wrong about that. I recently heard Daniel Ellsberg speak, and he argued that this avoidance of nuclear catastrophe so far was simply the result of dumb luck, and of course, the residual rationality of military and civilian leaders in both the United States and the Soviet Union. I wish, of course, that I could argue that, on the contrary, it was the result of a powerful peace movement. This is the sort of moral left lesson that the left likes. We survived, we could say, because people protested against nuclear madness by marching in the streets. Except, of course, that this moral lesson is manifestly untrue. Similarly, I believe massive climate marches, campaigns to persuade universities to divest from fossil fuel industries, and changes of personal behavior that appeal to a moralistic lifestyleism, like not flying, etc., are all unlikely to have any significant effects on either the political or the actual climate. There is furthermore a political danger, I'm almost finished, in taking one symptom of the general crisis and treating it as an existential and sui generis. If climate change is an imminent threat to the future of humanity and trumps, pun intended, all other political considerations, then the argument will be made that we must make political common cause with any political force, aka Democrats, who seem to espouse a basic rationality about the issue rather than denying the problem. To reject this capitulationist logic will then be denounced as ultra-leftist and irresponsible. This emotional blackmail must be resisted. I will stop now, though, and wait for the conversation.
Okay, I guess I'm on. Hi, everybody. It's good to see so many people here who are concerned with this existential threat that we face. You were talking about the history of the socialist movement. I'm kind of a living example of that. I joined the Young Socialist Alliance in 1960, and that was in Rhode Island School of Design. And then I...
It was the SWB youth group?
Yes, the youth group, the Socialist Workers' Party. I ran into a socialist. They convinced me that it was at the time of the Cuban Revolution. And I thought, Cuba's doing good things. Why are they attacking it? You know, it was like this. And that made me open up my mind to the world of possibilities of a different kind of world and system. So then I went to Baltimore. I was in the civil rights movement in Baltimore. I went to jail on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. That opened my eyes further to the sickness and toxicity of capitalism. And then I, after 1964, I had been in art school down there in Baltimore, graduated, and then moved up to Boston in 1964 when the beginnings, stirrings of the anti-war movement were starting. And what happened here was an explosion, if you'll remember, if you know the history, that a massive anti-war movement grew up. I became the coordinator of the giant anti-war coalition of over 40 organizations, every single campus in the city, and we had a demonstration of 100,000 on the Boston Common. So I am not pessimistic because I know, having lived through that period coming out of the 50s when I was in high school, that things can change overnight. And whereas things may look very bleak right now, it doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way. We don't know. You can't predict. An old socialist told me at one point, we can't predict what the working class is going to do. It moves. There's been suggested there's a 40-year period of radicalizations, but again, it is unpredictable, but I'm just living through that period where things changed overnight, and we really thought we were on the way to revolution. We really believed it. It didn't happen. It was squashed by the carrot and the stick, actually, repression and buying off people, but it wasn't time. So that is why I've maintained my belief, principal belief. I believe that you can't work within the two major parties. I was asked by Kevin, why did I transition from the Socialist Workers Party to the Green Party? And I actually didn't. I went into another group. After the SWP degenerated, I went into the Socialist Action, and I thought they were sectarian, so then I went into Solidarity, which I am in now, which has numerous tendencies, and I don't feel it's sectarian. And I made the transition to the Green Party as a socialist because mainly of Peter Camejo. If you know of him, he ran with Nader in 2000 and 2004 as his vice presidential candidate. And Peter was a fantastic organizer, a fantastic speaker, very principled, always anti-war. He came from Venezuela. He was in touch with the Latin American Revolution. And he threw himself into the Green Party, and that had a big influence on me. When I joined the Green Party, they were not socialist. And I was okay with that because most of the leadership was socialist. As a matter of fact, and secondly, they were principled for not working in the two major parties, saw the need to build a third working class party, and were consistently anti-war and anti-racist and pro-working class for an over 20-year period when all these other people were buckling and selling out and going in and supporting every Democrat that came up every 4 years. I saw that they stood their ground and didn't cave in, and are still not caving in. And that was why I could feel that they were very compatible with me. I also saw that the Green Party was going in a left-wing direction, and I was convinced that it would have to, given the crisis in our society. So I was right, because over 2 years ago, the party decided that it was eco-socialist, felt that their kind of socialism was on a higher level than a lot of the sectarian Marxism, And we're in the process of developing that. There are numerous tendencies and discussions going on and controversies and all kinds of things, but it's a good place for socialists to be. Now, I'm still a socialist because I wrote a series in 30 years ago. I wrote a series of articles for Socialist Action magazine or newspaper. A series of five articles, which I have brought today, and I went back to them and took them out and looked at them. I've reproduced them for you today if you would like to have one. And reading through it, I was appalled because everything I laid out, from the depth of the problem, the extent of the problem, the cause of the problem, whatever, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. And I went through the evolution of society, beginning with primitive communism, on through of Engels. I would recommend, if you haven't read Engels' Family, The Private Property in the State, read it to see how society evolved from primitive communism through slavery onto feudalism and into the capitalist dilemma that we have before us now. True, it was a problem of industrialization and capitalism, but then we saw the same problems developing in the Soviet Union, and I have a section in my articles on the Soviet Union. I can't go through the whole thing today. I would just encourage you to buy it, because when I returned to what I wrote, I thought, this lays it all out. This is it. And I still believe that we have to end capitalism. I don't see any way to control it. They can't control it. And we have not been able to control it. And the liberal answer has not worked. If you have a 60-year perspective on the movement like I do, you'll see the futility of this panic every 4 years to support the lesser evil. It's getting ridiculous, people. So I was going to go into a lot more about health. Let me just mention something on the health issue that I don't think is being confronted. If you look at industrial accidents, office sick building syndrome, and so on, most of our health problems are not inevitable. They're because we're being poisoned in one form or another, either on the job or in our schools or wherever. The corporations are making us sick, and they're passing on the cost of health care to the working class. And that's why now they're beginning to talk about maybe a Medicare system for all, but it will still be up to pay for it. Instead of taking the money for healthcare from the corporations, we have got to fight for the money coming from the military budget and from the corporate class and the wealthy. That's what we need to fight for. Now, is this realistic? Can we save the world? Can we save the planet? My feeling is very strongly that the mistake that has been made by the left is capitulating to the two major capitalist parties in this country. This country is the determinant of what's going to happen in the world. And when you have an entire left, every organization, either a left organization, socialist organization, or reform organization, instead of building for 60 years a working class party, they've been voting for the lesser evil or abstaining by being too pure. I'm going to say from the elections. And this has gotten us into the dilemma we are in now. And how can you justify it for 60 years? Now there's a letter out to the Green Party from Noam Chomsky and Barbara Ehrenreich, and probably a lot of you have seen it, begging the Green Party not to run in this election. Let me tell you, we originated the Green New Deal. In 2009, the Democrats picked it up in 2019. We started campaigning for Medicare for All. They're just picking it up now. So even if you say, well, the Green Party can't win, there is a reason for it to exist, because we bring the entire spectrum to the left. We force them to confront what the real issues of the working class are. So I feel that if there was unity on the left, if all these little groups that are ineffectual right now could come together and build a alternative third party, and the Green Party has already laid all the groundwork. We have the ballot status. We're going for ballot status in 50 states. Every single 4 years, we've gone up on the number of states that we get official ballot status. That we could, the problem in this country is that we don't have a party. We have mass movement after mass movement. Every issue you can name, whether it's women's movement, the anti-racist movement, whatever movement it is, mass actions, women's march, march after march. And then what? Then we vote the same people back in. That is the definition of insanity, in my opinion. And you have to be optimistic when you look at the Green Party to say, is this going to be the vehicle? Well, it could be if you all join it and make it into what we need. That's the problem. The left has stood aside and criticized it. We don't need critics. We need builders. We need people who come in with ideas. We need people who are fighters. And I think that's the way out of the impasse that we are in. I have brought on the piano, there's a reading list I suggest for you. I suggest Peter Camejo's book, his autobiography, North Star. I suggest the history of the SWP, what happened to it, it degenerated. There's two volumes written by Barry Shepherd which explain why it went awry. And a lot of it was disruption. We have to deal with the most powerful government on the planet. And they have a whole Homeland Security that's busy. What are they doing, you know? We have to take that into consideration when we think these organizations fail, that there's a lot of opposition to what we're trying to do. So I think I will end there. There's a lot more to be said, but I'd like to, if you're interested in the Green Party and getting active, I have a mailing list up here that you can attend and sign up for so we can be in touch. And we're going to be trying to expand our activities and do a lot more than we've been doing. So I think, is my time up?
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
I don't come from any public-facing political party or group. I'm just going to offer a viewpoint, one of many, see what you have to say about it. Thank you, Will, for putting this together. I think in our fight against fascism, the struggle, we must present a united front of many of our particularist groups, even if we have internal disagreements. I will always be there for the united front until it is no longer possible to do that. I was browsing the Platypus Statement of Purpose in advance of this panel, and many extraordinary things stood out to me in that moment. It was in the very first paragraph, I believe, and forgive me, Will and Richard, for paraphrasing, but one of the critical issues that Platypus has noted with its sort of question about, you know, the left is dead, long live the left, is asking the question, how can we on the left right now, what right have we to dismiss the utopian thinkers of the past as naive, as inevitably falling into the confines of, you know, autocracy or totalitarianism? What right have we to dismiss them entirely when we ourselves are so utterly directionless and disorganized and disunited when the forces of the far right, the radical oppressive center, fascism, what have you, are looming so ever present in our daily lives. That is, I think, the great one of the great failures of the left to address this this climate issue and this sort of catastrophe, if you will. We've forgotten that it's possible to be utopian, or at least historical in our thinking. We've forgotten what it's like to look back and read what the historical figures have said. And that said, I don't have any answers for the climate crisis, right? I'm not a scientist. I think there's great, you know, if the scientists say the water level is going to be this high in X amount of years, you know, that's what it's going to be, and there's no reason to doubt that. And we must deal with the crises that emerge from that. However, I don't know if that can be done in the confines of the state, right? So what we see is, and I'm drawing on both Benjamin and Zizek in this moment, we see these cycles. We see a state emerge out of some, you know, political consolidation or a divine right of a king or whatever, whatever you have. And that state grows in power and grows in force, and maybe there's a revolution, maybe the state is overthrown. But then there's a counter-revolution, and then another state simply emerges and falls in line, and it's still the same kind of violence and forces from above against the working class, against the people, against the suffering of the masses and all of us, against the suffering of our souls, if you will. There's the old question of what do we do, what are the solutions? The list that our friend from the DSA gave in the very first panel of solutions, I think, are admirable and realistic, and we should fight for those solutions, Green New Deal, whatever, as long as we can. And yet, a viewpoint I'm going to offer is maybe not a solution, not a realistic viewpoint, if you will. I want to raise the question of how we respond to the, I hate to say the inevitable, but to the untold sufferings that are going to emerge from climate displacement, drought, everything from, you know, office health syndrome, you know, the asbestos, whatever you have, the floods, the waves, the any number of imaginable sort of catastrophes that can and will emerge from this industrialized human global world. As I said, united front among all parties and affiliations to fight for that. If that sort of inevitably fails, what do we do? And this is not a wish for that to fail, right? I want to be very clear with that. The panel presentation offered the question of doom and hope as, I think, two alternative viewpoints. And I, with due respect, maybe reject that dichotomy. There certainly is doom on the horizon, but I also see that there can be a world of hope in how we respond. I arise, as you may or may not have guessed, from a train of thought that originates with Kropotkin, and a train of thought that might have been called at one point anarcho-communist. I also am influenced by figures like Georges Bataille, who, against the traditional anarcho-communists, note the need for sort of sacredness and enchantment and ritual in fighting fascism in our small sort of groups and sort of local communes as we fight to survive. And many see this arising from a sort of utopian viewpoint. They say if mutual aid is so biologically natural and inherent to humanity, why has it failed? Why have we given in to the forces of egotism and oppression, and why have all societies sort of fought to quash these motions? And I say to this, it hasn't failed. Mutual aid, we see it in nature. If many of you saw that viral video that was going around the internet recently of the fox and the badger figuring out how to get under the highway. That's mutual aid at its finest. And you know, I'm not a sort of biological determinist by any means, but I do think it is inherent. Cooperation is inherent to our socialization and being as humans. We see this in our friendships. Our friendships don't need the state to endure. Our relationships, many of our romantic relationships even, are questions of how do we engage with each other as people on an interpersonal, intrapersonal level. We can build a sort of, I think, a utopian, response to these horrors that we're all seeing that is not that does not necessitate the state, that does not necessitate the electoral process as we know it. It's the old question of the resistance fighter, right, who wants to join the resistance in World War II, but also has a very sick family member, and this fighter can't decide who to dedicate their energies towards, taking care of the sick family member or putting themselves entirely into the resistance. And what the fighter really wants to do is say to the family member, right, I'm going off to the resistance, and say to the members of the resistance, I'm going off to take care of the family member, and instead, in that moment, sort of retreats into the bounds of self-study and learning and facilitating and questioning and building the relationships and societal structures that this person might want, wherein they can take care of both the family member and be a part of the resistance. Mm-hmm. I'm more inclined to discussion than monologue at this point, and I do recognize that it's not a common view to hold, and I do want to just end by being very, very clear. I'm not advocating for a retreat from society. I'm not advocating for libertarian nonsense that's extraordinarily egotistic and selfish and individual, like the false notion of individualism. Rather, individualization via the collective effort in smaller, local, communal collectives coming together, grounded perhaps in a common ritual, grounded in a sacred notion that each group chooses to engage with on their own, and that's the response. And right now, I'm actually very much committed to joining in with the Green Party, the DSA, whoever else, in a united front to try to address the malevolent forces of the far right and the radical center that are seeking to hold us down and who are ultimately responsible for the climate crisis as it so exists today. So I really look forward to the discussion on that, and I think I'll turn it back to Will.
Great, thank you. So just some notes that I made to myself for these brief responses. Nafis, you kind of brought up the science side that we didn't get to as much in the other perspectives, but I'm curious how that relates to the political, and if you could talk a little about that in your responses. Richard, you brought up this sort of division between radical rhetoric and reformist politics, and I'm curious how that disparity developed historically or what's behind that. Linda, you talked about the Green Party as the solution, as the working class party, and I'm curious, I think there's a socialist question of, well, is the Green Party the socialist party that has historically been called for by various Marxists, or I guess responding to the skepticism of, you know, maybe a third party, but is it the mass socialist party that may be necessary? And then Alexander, you brought up some more personal angles in terms of responses, the soul, friendship, utopia, and I'm curious how that relates to politics in how utopia explicitly doesn't have to be an anti-political, but how it can be a political concept. So if each each of you 2 or 3 minute response to some of these provocations and also just to what you heard from your fellow panelists.
Sure, yeah. So I actually like, if I can just say that I like what Alexander had to say, that it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be a dichotomy of doom and hope. I think there's a phrase that's usually attributed to Gramsci that says, you know, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. And I'm a firm believer in that. The reason why I brought up science is because what are the solutions to the climate crisis that are being, you know, proposed right now? Like, what can we do? How do we cut emissions? Is there anything, like, for example, geoengineering is a very lucrative solution that are being forwarded by technocrats and some eco-modernists who are, I'm not sure if you're familiar with fully automated luxury communism that began as a meme and now is a movement. It's also a book. But there are folks on the left who would agree, you know, argue for a modernist or a utopian future that is based on technology, right? And even why, like, how we got here is, you know, explanations are derived from scientific research. But the main narrative in science in the last, you know, 6 decades has been one of, you know, political sterility. Science in the United States is completely removed from any sort of political affiliation. If you go to an academic department, a scientific one, if you have political biases, you are told that that is not relevant because, you know, science is apolitical. Even in the liberal or even the radical environmentalist movement will tell you that science is apolitical. Science is all about rationality. But under the guise of rationality, what has been advanced is a neoliberal program. Essentially, all modern science is a product of capitalism. If you read Richard Levins and Richard Lewontin, they wrote a book called The Dialectical Biologist, in which they completely describe the commoditization of science, where scientific research through increased private and public partnerships has been accosted by the capitalist program, right? So I think this is why it's important to recognize where the left missed out on scientific advances. Why is there no leftist science? Why is there no Marxist science beyond just like mistakes made by Lysenko, right? Because that was just one instance. Okay, the other thing to notice is that, you know, on the left right now, there are trains of thoughts that come back to the idea of like, what does it mean to have a good living, right? Like, for example, ideas of degrowth or ideas born from indigenous thought and practice. And how does this relate to what we can propose as solutions to climate change is that all of these ideas are hinged on the same premise as a Marxist premise, is that your relationship with the nature is one of a dialectical one. And that's why I brought that up. So this disconnect represents the disconnect between theory and praxis. And as Marx would have it, you need to have unity of theory and praxis for any sort of Marxist movement. So that's essentially how I see the science and the political to be tied together. If the solutions to climate crisis, such as cutting emissions, need to be based on science, they also need to be understood in a political context, because you cannot just remove it. Another example I'd give is that, for example, if you are talking about deploying solar, there is a big discrepancy about who can actually deploy solar on their rooftops. And you can see that thanks to all the racist policies in the United States, people of color have disproportionately lower solar deployment within the same income range. So it's not necessarily only a matter of class, it's also a matter of race here. Thanks.
So I have a brief comment for each one of my panelists. So first of all, it's interesting you brought up dialectics of nature. And the John Bellamy Foster, that's dialectics of nature. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting argument. So I want to say, first of all, I'm not necessarily a fan of the book Dialectics of Nature. But second of all, I don't think that the problems with environmental policy in Stalinist regimes had anything to do with philosophy. I think they had to do with, number one, bureaucratic incompetence, and number two, lack of democracy. And I don't think that philosophy... I think the problem with Lysenko is a combination of pseudoscience backed by state power. And again, not fundamental philosophical problem. I think that I am actually would defend what the position you described as Promethean, like a classical Marxist position. I think degrowth is a non-starter as a political position, because most people on the planet are miserably poor and it offers nothing to them. I don't think that the idea of going to a pre-industrial society is even viable. I think that it's fundamentally a utopian position that can't be implemented as any practical political policy. So I think that the question is fundamentally how we make industrial civilization, which is in fact the basis of freedom and the possibility of a liberated society for all human beings on the planet, how we make that function in a way that doesn't threaten itself, threaten humanity, right? And that to me is a matter of implementing a global rationality as opposed to the partial rationality of capitalism, right? So it's a kind of classical defense of kind of enlightenment rationality and as Marxism is the continuation of that. So in response to the question of the state, so I also like your talk, I like the tone of it. So the problem with what you're saying is that any immediate solution to climate change involves the state. It involves state policies. And in fact, one of the main problems that we have in the world is that there are a plurality of states, right? In other words, the problem would be much more easily addressed if you had a single state, obviously a socialist state, but even a single global capitalist state, the problem would be easier to address because it's the plurality of states and the issue of nationalism greatly exacerbates the problem, as does capitalism. So one of the great crimes of capitalism is the perpetuation of the nation state. So on the Green Party, so full disclosure, I have voted several times for the Green Party, and I hope to vote again because it will be the only option to the left of the Democrats on the ballot. But I would also say that in voting for the Green Party, what I feel the Green Party does, and you kind of alluded to it, is it's not really an independent socialist politics. I don't see it that way. I see it as a left-wing pressure on the Democrats. In that sense, it doesn't seem to me fundamentally different from the DSA, which operates within the Democratic Party. So I don't really see that much difference between somebody voting for Bernie Sanders or voting for the Greens. Mm-hmm. Except that I personally loathe voting for Democrats.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll take that as some of the questions were directed about the Green Party. It's in transition. It's malleable. So the only thing I can say, it's not what I want now. Is it the working class party we need? Obviously not. But it's, you have to start somewhere. And when you take, it's very hard to learn how to get ballot status and learn the electoral requirements. They have all kind of these restrictions about how you can raise money and everything. Well, you know, they've been doing that for 20 years. So it's just they're waiting to be used by the left, is my opinion. That's the way I look at it. I'm not happy with everything about it, but, you know, it just is standing outside of the only alternative we have in the electoral arena and criticizing it is counterproductive, folks. You know, it's better to get in there and make it better. And it does have a number of tendencies, and the debate is ongoing. You know, your ideas would be welcome, both of you. I'm also in DSA. I'm in solidarity. I try to work with all the groups. So I'm in Metro West DSA, and we have to take up the spoiler argument. Is the Green Party a spoiler? We're having a workshop in Metro West presented by the Green Party that will deal with that issue. And it's very enlightening, trust me, because a lot of people get stampeded into voting for the two major parties because of that issue. Now, if we want to take a look at Marxism and its failure, to me, a large part of that failure that Trotskyist analysis never took into account was the fact that it didn't abolish patriarchy. The main problem in the world today, in my opinion, is not only capitalism, but it's capitalist patriarchy. Every time there's been a revolutionary movement, whether it was Nicaragua or the Soviet Union or whatever, they never abolished patriarchy. You can look at North Korea, look at China, look at their patriarchies. And that has got to be abolished. The origin of the state and patriarchy were simultaneous. I don't think there's a problem with a plethora of states. The problem is imperialism and the domination of the globe by the United States and the other imperialist powers. And whereas there was a tremendous colonial revolution at one point, now it's all neocolonialism. They're so smart. It seems like they're always a step ahead of us. And that's why we need a collective of the best brains, which I love this discussion. Let's get together collectively and solve these problems. Now, I know it looks bad right now, but as I said, when you see things change overnight. Now, I just want to, I think geoengineering is already proceeding. I think they're keeping all this stuff secret. We don't know what's the space program. Oh my God, we don't know what's going on with that. I believe that they're very seriously considering and probably already implementing geoengineering. I think the problem with the Soviet Union was all tied in with patriarchy is it became undialectical. They stopped seeing things in its whole relationship in the globe, and that was because they believed in socialism in one country. You can't have socialism in one country. It has to be a global system. So I think that any eco-socialist or any environmentalist has to be for socialism because what it's advocating is a planned economy. And the chaos that's been created that we face today is because it is planned for profit, not for human needs. So I'll just end on that.
Thank you. So with that, we will open up for Q&A discussion. We don't have a mic, obviously, so just raise your hand and...
No.
Oh, I'm very sorry. That's
what always happens to anarcho-communists. Hey. No worries.
Go ahead, my bad.
No, you're good. I would just, in brief, because I really am looking forward to opening it up to the collective whole, just thanks to Richard for articulating much more clearly a point I was making about sort of the nation state and the many nation states being one of the great sort of horrors and abominations that has arisen out of the historical trajectory in which we find ourselves. And this is inclusive of the horrors of patriarchy, add sort of questions of racism, classism into that discussion as well. And what it really comes down to is the nature of our relationships to one another. And I do use the term soul, maybe more personally. I'm aware that's imbued with sort of theological implications that don't apply to, maybe even the vast majority of people, or would apply in a different way to many folks than it does apply to me. Really just the freedom to determine those relationships and those the rules we want to set for each other in terms of gender and what our genders are and what our sexual relationships are like and what our communal relationships are like. The freedom to make those determinations sort of, I don't know. It's always against, it's always against fascism, right? Always against patriarchy, always against authoritarianism.
Sorry again for interrupting you, cutting you off. So now let's open up for Q&A. Looks like we have two questions already. We'll start here and then back. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. How do you see the revolution? I have two questions. So how do you see the revolution actually taking place? So what are the steps, or how do you plan that happening? And also, as the big meme goes, when a libertarian left revolution happens and an authoritarian government comes in and takes over at the last second. Are you at all concerned about that in your plan for, you know, well, not plan, but ideal for a revolution?
I'll start. I think patriarchy had a lot to do with the derailing of the all previous revolutions. Trotsky said to have a transitional program, you have to engage the masses in transitional demands, that is day-to-day things that relate to their everyday life, with the view of having the long-term demand of overturning the state of that exists under capitalism. And I think that what happened in the Soviet Union was there were tremendous freedoms for women. They set up nurseries and there were going to be communal kitchens and all that. And then when the Stalinism began to grow, they began to negate all that. And women have always been used in revolutions. And then as soon as the revolution is complete, we're sent back to the kitchen. And that happened in Cuba, and there's a tremendous struggle going on. I've been to Cuba twice. There's a tremendous struggle going on in Cuba that was against the homophobia that existed because of the Catholic tradition. And Mariel Castro, who is launching, it was just phenomenal, this wonderful campaign in Cuba against homophobia. But that's coming from the women. And I think in order to complete the revolution, to make it lasting, that we have to include women in the leadership and meet their demands. Same with the oppressed communities. Until they are liberated and their demands are acknowledged in a revolutionary process, it's not going to be a full, complete revolution that leads to liberation instead of further bureaucracy and repression and so on. So that's the way I look at it. And it's a fight. It's that's the challenge. Are we up to it? Are we going to engage in this? I haven't been able to let it go in 60 years, and maybe I'm just, I don't know, just a Pollyanna, but I don't think so. I still think we can do it, and we have to do it, or there's no hope. You can look at Mars and Venus. That's a whole discussion, but their ozone layer is gone and they're uninhabitable, so we know where that goes. One thing I want to mention that hasn't been focused on is the ozone layer is still a problem. Somehow it dropped out of the discourse. Have you noticed? Like somehow they've solved the problem. They haven't. Just check it out. And we have to be, because that's causing a lot of diseases, the thin ozone layer. They did slow it down, but it's still a problem. So that needs to be more focused on and investigated.
Also, is a greenhouse gas, isn't it? Lower now?
What's that?
It is, but I think it's not.
Not a major factor.
Yeah.
But it's also.
Can you speak up? What was that, Richard?
That ozone is also a greenhouse gas, as
right.
Well as, like, it's a double issue.
Yeah, but then it's used there to. The layer of ozone is not necessarily in the immediate stratosphere.
No, they're two different. It's at a lower level, right?
The lower level is
okay.
The problem now. They've somewhat healed the upper layer, but now they ban the CFCs and they're looking at HFCs. But now the lower level is other chemicals that they think are influencing the lower level. So all I'm saying is let's not drop the issue. It's still a problem.
So I guess there are two questions. One is the question of, like, can you have a revolution? Is a revolution inevitably going to lead to some sort of horrible dictatorship in the gulag? And that's a rational fear based on the history of the 20th century. I mean, the question is, like, what do you see as the future under endless liberal capitalism? Does that really offer a future for humanity? That would be my argument for. But the question, so we're talking about two types of questions, I think. One is a question about, like, things like patriarchy, socialism, freedom. I don't think that I think that it is possible that ecological catastrophe can be avoided under capitalism. In other words, that to me seems a different type of problem. It's not a problem of human freedom. It's fundamentally a technical problem. And what needs to be done is quite clearly known. And the problem is politically implementing it, even under capitalism. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with certain private interests of certain capitalists and the plurality of nation states and nationalism and, in certain cases, irrational ideologies. So I think that one has to hope, actually, that climate change is a problem that can actually be addressed under capitalism. Because if not, then things can be really bad. And as I said, if you have, you know, if things get as bad as some of the more alarmist predictions, I don't think that that's going to make people rebel. I think that that's going to lead to fascism, authoritarianism, greater racism, etc. So.
Good. That's the point.
And I'd just add your question and your response, Richard, there, and Linda, sort of raises our need for sort of maintaining constant vigilance at all times. And it's against these grand forces, fascism, racism, right? These horrifying things that trickle down into individual acts. But it's also things like fighting against the violence that two people can do to each other on the individual level, and right, maintaining vigilance against that. That's for fear of rambling off. I'd offer that it'd be one thing to, you know, snap the fingers Thanos style and have all the, you know, communes pop up in a loosely federated, you know, world of self-sustaining agriculture. Like, I know that's not going to happen. And we just have to maintain that constant vigilance against these forces as we work towards liberation.
Next question.
So,
Soren? Thank you all for my name's Soren, and I'm a member of Platypus, and I wanted to pick up on Richard's categorization or sort of tripartite distinction of non-climate deniers. So, correct me if I'm wrong, you identified more or less, I think, what you call a liberal position, which is more or less a sort of a reformist.
The mainstream position.
Sure. And then the radical position, which sees the problem as industrial society, and the socialist position, which sees the problem as capitalist society. And I was originally thinking that I would ask you a question about, given that framework, what would you say about Trump's policies and or rhetoric vis-a-vis the environment? But I think there's a different question that's more interesting to ask, and that is to put that tripartite distinction that Richard articulated to the rest of the panel, and perhaps actually Richard, back to yourself as well, which is to say, do you recognize yourself in either of those three categories? If not, why not? How so? How would you identify your own political outlook such that it doesn't fit to one of those three categories? If you would identify yourself in one of those three categories, but you nevertheless think that Richard's articulation of it was erroneous or in some fashion, how would you defend that position? And I'd just be curious to hear from each of the three other panelists. And again, as I say, ultimately, perhaps Richard yourself, if you fit into any of those three categories, if not, why not? If so, defend yourself against, you know, Richard's critiques of that position as he articulated them.
Sure, I can. It's okay, I'll like to go first on this one. you know, how Richard described the three, actually, I like the, you know, this liberal and the radical categories are pretty straightforward. Is there a question? Or?
Oh, no, next question.
Sorry. Oh, okay, yes. yeah, as far as the socialist categorization go, you know, there is, I would like to say, I do identify as an eco-socialist, more specifically an eco-Marxist, and the reason why I blabbered on about theory in the beginning is because I believe that there is a way to integrate, you know, the theory and practice of dialectical materialism, which is essentially, my belief is required for if we are to meet up to the challenges of the climate crisis and associated rising inequality and fascism. I mean, I don't necessarily, you know, I think the question of the question of the nation states is very important, as both Richard and Alexander brought up, because you could, it's pretty clear at this point that Trump's policies of like closing the border is going to be reflected across other developed nations as they see more migrant influx, regardless of whether social democrats or not. Especially Denmark has already shown how racist it can be with its migrant policies. But also, like, I don't quite, actually, I guess, like, my question to Richard is that why is there a fallacy in the socialist categorization? Like, why is the socialist category not rising to meet up the challenge of the climate crisis, according to you?
I can answer that. So I identify of those three categories most with the socialist. The problem is that, again, I think that climate change is ultimately a technical problem, and therefore it is perfectly conceivable to me that climate change can be addressed under capitalism, and I hope that it is, because I don't see socialist revolution on the agenda anytime soon. In other words, because of the political weakness of socialism as a goal, I think the only hope of actually addressing climate change within a reasonable time frame lies with the idea that the bourgeoisie is not totally irrational and will take necessary regulatory action to control climate change. And those are, like, all of the UN talks, the Kyoto Protocol, the Paris talks, all of that assumes capitalism. The Green New Deal assumes capitalism, right? I'm not against any of those things happening, but let's call them what they are. Those are assuming the persistence of capitalism. I would rather a world without capitalism. But there are lots of reasons for wanting capitalism abolished other than to prevent ecological catastrophe. And I would want ecological catastrophe to be stopped even before we have socialism, or if we don't have socialism, rather than just waiting for socialism, right? And there's a fallacy and a danger of saying the only way you can address this problem is through socialism, because I don't think that that's actually factually correct, and I hope it's not factually correct.
Well, I don't see any contradiction between fighting for everything under the system that we live in. That's what the Green New Deal, I do have, this is the Green Party's Green New Deal and the critique of the Democratic Party Green New Deal, which they stole from us and watered down. The Democratic Party solutions are no solutions whatsoever. And
but do you think that they're likely to pass?
What's likely to pass?
The Democrats who are advocating.
No, I think if you look at the history of the Democratic Party, what they do is give lip service when there's a mass movement and enough demand on them, then they'll give lip service. When they're in power, they don't enact what they're advocating. And when they're out of power, I actually think they're more comfortable with the Republicans in power because they have them as an excuse. That's just repeated over and over again. It should be obvious to us by now, but to a lot of people who keep voting lesser evil, it isn't, unfortunately. But I think we have to fight for realistic transition to anything. I'm for solar power. Let's fight for solar power. Get it everywhere we can. Everything to ameliorate the crisis. But I think that we see the direction that capitalism and imperialism is headed under Trump. I'm beginning to see in the media, and the media is our main problem. We are so controlled and brainwashed. This, what is it, 2 years of electioneering? That's brainwashing. It's all propaganda. They aren't discussing anything anymore. No news. You know things are going on in Venezuela, but we don't hear about it. So, you know, we've got a real problem. Somehow, I think Democracy Now! Does a good job. It goes so far, but I talk to working people, and they never heard of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Doesn't want to admit that. They're doing a good job, but they need more support, and we need, they also exclude the Green Party. Because most of them are Democrats. I think we have to fight for everything we can get under capitalism. I believe, seeing the resistance we're getting and the direction the Trump government is going, that there will be such opposition that the working class will be forced to go into a revolutionary period. Whether that's victorious or not remains to be seen.
I think a large part of the working class voted for Trump. So I'm not convinced that there's massive resistance, and I think there's a good chance that Trump will be reelected. But I also want to say that, you know, saying that climate change could conceivably be addressed under capitalism is not to say that that's a reason for keeping capitalism. In other words, like, I think that it is fundamentally important for the ultimate future of humanity. Like, maybe not 5 or 10 years. I think that's like the world's gonna end in a few years is a dangerous distraction to scare people. But I do think that capitalism as a social system is ultimately unsustainable in the long run.
Real quick, before we...
Yeah, actually, I unfortunately have to go. But I did want to respond to something Richard said. Is I don't think there is, you know, I agree that there is no socialist revolution at the horizon imminent right now. It is going to take a lot more basic work, solidarity work across the world to build up to that. But I don't think that you can necessarily, you know, address the climate crisis with keeping in mind the idea of freedom for all humanity without abolishing capitalism. And one other thing I want to address is that a lot of the times when the Green New Deal is brought up, it's being discussed at a federal level policy, right? And that's not necessarily true, because as we are waiting, and you know, this is probably one of the bourgeois regulatory solutions you're talking about, but it is still applicable at the city level, at the state level. Even, for example, one of the cornerstones of the DSA's radical Green New Deal is to promote energy democracy campaigns across the chapters, and there's several chapters working on it. And the goal is to create community-owned energy grids. Currently, I'm sure most of you know, is that your energy is provided by private utilities, right? So one of the, that taking your grid back, essentially, from the hands of investor-owned utilities does empower workers and the community that you live in. Sure, it's not abolishing capitalism, but essentially it does get us even a tiny bit closer to the ultimate goal of a socialist mode of production, right? Yeah, I think I'm gonna end there. But thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great time to Right, so we have a question in the back and then here, and I'll just ask the panelists to try to keep your answers to less than 2 minutes, just so we can get in all the questions in the next 25 minutes.
Yeah, so a lot of the left, since, you know, around the time Linda got her first footing on the left, feel that the sort of biggest problem with environmentalism is that, you know, human beings consume like way too much, and this seems to fit into a sort of schema that, you know, liberal democracy, the Enlightenment, etc., maybe we ultimately regret those things. And so you won't like, and so you'll have these sort of like, oh, let's return to prima modernity, right? That might be a viable leftist sort of position. and so where, you know, people were like far more, you know, under assault from nature than we are today. And so what is missing from that perspective is one of, say, freedom that was taken up in the sort of American French revolutions and also the sort of socialist sort of part, mass socialist parties at the outset of the 20th century. I was wondering if you guys could reflect on what accounts for this sort of shift that happens in the 20th century towards addressing these sort of concerns.
Well, I think a lot of the skepticism had to do with the negative experience of Stalinism. And I think also that it's like, it's a phenomenon of the later 20th century, not the earlier and middle. So it's like from the post-New Left and after the breakup from the 70s, particularly on 60s and 70s. But I mean, in terms of like resources, again, the question is not absolute resources. The question is, do you imagine that resources can be provided for human beings, like you're talking about energy resources, in a way that is sustainable, right? And a lot of these questions, actually, I will claim, are technical. I mean, there is a political aspect to them, but there's also a technical aspect, right? I mean, the one of the consequences of the Industrial Revolution is the energy resources available to human beings and to society were massively increased. And that had, particularly through the burning of fossil fuels, has unintended consequences. But it's not necessarily a function of industrial civilization that it has to depend upon fossil fuels, or that fossil fuels, it's perfectly conceivable, even under capitalism, that you can have a capitalism dependent upon nuclear energy or solar energy. We didn't talk about the issue of nuclear energy here. And similarly with socialism, right? You can imagine that in the future that humanity would tap the entire energy. You know, people spoke of a Dyson sphere, the entire energy of the sun. I'm, by the way, not inherently against, I mean, a lot of the argument against geoengineering seems to me based upon a moral hazard argument, that you encourage people to believe in geoengineering and you're avoiding the obvious solution of cutting back on carbon emissions. And again, because of the way society functions, the distribution of any suffering from a transition, right, is disproportionately burdened onto the working class, the poor. The disproportionate victimization of people by the consequences of climate change, it'll be particularly people in third world countries who will suffer the most, right? Those are social aspects. But again, I think that the technical knowledge, right, is fundamentally there. It's a problem of applying it, even under the social system we have today, without a revolution.
Okay, I think we have to take up the question of the war budget and the military under imperialism. And just to...
And not freedom.
Pardon?
And not freedom.
And no freedom now. We are not making the decisions. There is no democracy in the United States. Let's face it. The two-party system is... some people say it's broken. I don't say it's broken. I say it's working perfectly to keep the rich in power. Just a brilliant system to maintain the capitalist system and the problems we're experiencing. Now, I don't think we can return to a pre-industrial society. I don't think industrialization is the problem. I think corporate industrialization is the problem, with the control of industrialization in a very small minority at the top of society, and with the drive for profits. That's what corrupts everything. They aren't planning for human needs. And even the failed Soviet Union at its best did more planning for human needs than capitalism. And the loss of the worker state there was a setback for the world revolution that has given us the at least some of the colonial revolutions had the support of the Soviet Union while it existed. Now there's no state support for revolutionary movements around the globe. But anyway, Barry Commoner, which I suggest everybody read, said that restoring our damaged ecosystem would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. Commoner states, perhaps the simplest way to summarize all this is that most of the nation's resources for capital investment would need to be engaged in the task of ecological construction for at least a generation. And instead of the ruling class embarking on such a restoration is going in the opposite direction of further drilling, offshore drilling, and so on, escalating the problem. So until we deal with the question of war, imperialism, and the military budget, the Green Party says that we have to cut the military budget. There's a discussion in the party over it should be 50% or 75%. But the fact is that there's no way we're going to be able to heal the damage and restore the system to a non-toxic way of operating without using the money that is currently in the military budget. And the two major parties are united on that budget. The Democrats have never put up any serious opposition to every time it comes up for a vote. And the Green New Deal that we propose is contingent upon cutting the military budget. Now, are we going to be able to do it? I don't know. It depends on the youth. You know, are you going to embark on the road to independent political action or just keep succumbing to lesser evil every time there's an election? What the left failed to grasp, I think, at least in the last 20 years, was that to most Americans, politics is electoral. And the left didn't see that. We thought it was mass movements and everything else. And it mass action is a big part of it. Organizing demonstrations, immigration, on all these different issues, the Women's March, that's part of it. But when it comes down to deciding who's going to control the state, that's the electoral arena. And the left has to get into it in a meaningful way. And to me, it's independent. So I'll just end there.
I've forgotten the question, I'm afraid. I'm sorry.
Yeah, do you want to just rephrase real quick?
Yeah, that it seems a lot of concerns on the left, right, after, say, some point in the 20th century seems to be, if it is about environmentalism, it is about we should, you know, we're consuming too much, we might want to return to pre-modern states of life, as opposed to being tasked by, like, the peculiarly modern notion of freedom that modernity brings.
And just to color that question a little bit more, I feel like Richard was getting at this point that like, we can address the technical aspects of ecological disaster without touching the question of freedom as socialism has historically mm-hmm. addressed it. So that's, I think, one way of also...
I would also say I think historically there's a relationship with the rise of a kind of ecological politics as sort of central to the political imagination and the sense of Marxist failure and the sense that Marxism is part of a failed modernist project. So I think there's a direct connection, and I think that eco-socialism is an attempt to split the difference. I mean, I don't object to the phrase eco-socialism, but I think that it's somewhat misleading in a lot of these arguments about how Marxist so-called, you know, the ignored ecological texts. I think that those are illusions, and I don't think they matter to the fundamental problem. I mean, so yes, I think Marxism is about freedom. I think that, yes, exactly. I think one can address the ecological catastrophe without addressing the question of freedom. As far as the military budget is concerned, I don't think you can necessarily defund imperialism. In other words, a smaller military budget wouldn't mean the end of imperialism. Also, apparently, the Pentagon takes climate change very seriously. And they have, like, definitely thought about it in terms of war planning. And they see this as increasing the need for intervention and political chaos. So whatever Trump says, the Pentagon takes climate change seriously.
So we have a question right here and then one in the back. After that, we might have time for one more, but we'll try to finish right at 6. So if anyone else has a dying question, raise your hand now or in the next few minutes. All right, so third. So I think 3 will be it, unfortunately, but try to make this get those 3 questions in. So.
Okay. Hi, my name's Matt. I'm with the Green Party. I think it was an interesting discussion, but I feel like maybe kind of like from where we are now, it's making me think that maybe we should have defined our terms a little bit more at the beginning about like just like what is the climate crisis and what do we see happening in the next 10, 20 years? Like, for me, particularly provoking is this idea that we can have somehow address the climate crisis under capitalism. And to me, this just seems like really hard to conceptualize. So I guess my question to the panel is like, in 10, 20 years, when sea levels rise and our cities are flooded and people are, you know, most of our populations around the world are in cities on coasts or migrating inland, so we're going to have like people from South Boston camping out on the campus of BC, and we don't have any international trade anymore because you can't, you know, there are no docks for these giant ships that bring us stuff from around the world. And by the way, the crops are failing, so there's no food on the shelves of the grocery stores, and there's forest fires from, you know, Australia to Russia to, you know, California. Like this kind of, to me, it just kind of, everything is pointing towards a massive die-off. Maybe not extinction. I see the Extinction Rebellion thing. So I think other species are probably already are going extinct, but for humans, even for us, like, is the capitalist class going to accommodate these refugees? Are they going to find an alternative system to feed us, or are they going to build palaces with guards? And that, the latter seems a lot more likely to me. What's his name? Elon Musk is going to build his palace on Mars or something like that. So, you know, what do we? So it's not just a question of the continuation of capitalism as we have it now, but it's some kind of like really dystopian kind of fascism or socialism. And I don't see that. I see that as being kind of foisted on us. And so the challenge isn't, it's not the technology. It's not like we don't know how to like somehow figure out and manage the system. It's not money, which is just a metaphor for managing resources. And we have all this wealth. And it seems to me the question is political will and political imagination. I'd just like to hear.
Go ahead, you haven't spoken as much of you.
I just offer very briefly, this is where I'm aware that my utopianism is perhaps naive, and the question of hope in doom arises. I would say I can hope in the face of these catastrophes and these sufferings that we will recall our what is maybe natural or conditions or whatever, our desire for mutual aid and just helping each other out. And I know that's hopelessly naive, which is why I'm not out there fighting against other forms of leftism or anything. If the dystopian fascist corporate Musk, Elon Musk, whatever, comes to being, I'm right there, you know, in the fight. Assuming I've survived, right?
I think it's here. The dystopian horror is here.
Yeah.
They're taught. Reread 1984. It just came on Democracy Now. They're destroying the National Archive records they don't like. That's right out of Orwell. It's here. And the impact on the black community, they have been living under fascism for decades. It's not like it's coming. Now it's coming for more of us, but the problem is the media, the brainwashing, the the making us feel like there are only two parties, and that's politics, and this 24/7 drenching us with electoral news, and you know the fail, this the impeachment attempt by the Democrats was so pathetic. They didn't bring him up on any of the crimes he's committed. But this thing that fit into their right-wing scenario from the right about anti-Russia propaganda, it was a joke. Of course, they weren't going to win, but they could have made a lot of points if they, you know, even just raised Stormy Daniels, for God's sake. Anyway, I'll end there. I know we want to get to the other things, but I think, you know, I respect a lot of the points you made, but I really think the drive to profits, the falling rate of profit, they're compelled. You can't control capitalism. They're driven for the need to make profits and go into other areas and control colonial markets and so on. I just don't see it. I'm not saying they can't make they are making technological advantages, but they aren't going to solve the problem.
So I would argue that the politics of the Green Party and the politics of DSA are actually premised on the idea that you can address global warming, climate change under capitalism, because otherwise policies like the Green New Deal don't make any sense. These are policies to address climate change under capitalism. The policies of the United Nations, the various protocols, all of these things, all of these presume capitalism. So I think that that is the standard approach. And will that work? I don't know. I don't know what there will be political will to do. I don't know about the science. I don't know what will actually happen. I'm just saying that it seems to me theoretically possible and something to be hoped for, because otherwise we're really screwed. Also, yes, all the stuff about production for profit, the anarchy of capitalism, etc., all of that is absolutely true. And it's why I made the point that in the long run, capitalism is unsustainable. But it's also true that capitalists can make profits, as I said, by making zero emission vehicles, by making solar panels. It's not the case that the only way a capitalist can make a profit is by despoiling the environment. That's the logic behind the Green New Deal, that there can be a capitalism which is environmentally responsible. So I'm just saying, let's call that what it is. You don't need to expropriate the bourgeoisie. I wish you people would. You do not need to expropriate the bourgeoisie, probably, to address climate change. What you need is a strict regulatory climate. The main obstacle to that are the self-interest of a certain part of the capitalist class and the existence of multiple nation states. That's my claim. I also don't think we live under fascism or are immediately headed towards fascism. I think we live under bourgeois democracy, and the wretched government we have is the product of bourgeois democracy, not fascism, and I think it's very important to be sober about using those terms. The world could be immensely worse than it is. It might become immensely worse. It is not yet that. There are many possibilities for political struggle within the present environment.
Thank you. So two more questions to address. Divya, and then in the back.
Could you speak up a little?
Whether you identify as reformist, radical, or socialist, it's a kind of expansion of that question. And I think Nafis, who's not here, identified explicitly as a socialist, but also mentioned a reformist kind of strategy. I think, Richard, you said you were very clearly on the socialist side, and Linda, I think you too would be on the socialist side, but there are two very different kinds of political positions. Richard sounds to me very very melancholy in terms of the prospects for socialism, And Linda, I think you have a much more sanguine or optimistic or utopian view. And I just had a question for Linda, which is, you know, how would you define socialism? I mean, you know, how did you define it when you first considered yourself a socialist? And then what was the change that happened? What was the turn away from kind of sectarian Marxism to eco-socialism? And how does you know, this category of eco-socialist alter the definition of socialism you might have had before you you took it up?
Well, I think it's not a change, it's a return to the original dialectic way of looking at the world that Marx foresaw. We can't go into a lot of it here, but I'd recommend Huberman and Sweezy and Monthly Review, which does a lot of environmental study, scientific study, that I subscribe to them. They're very good, and they're trying to bring Marxism up to date. Marx couldn't prophesy everything that was going to happen, and no socialist can stay stuck in the past. You have to evolve the way society is evolving and deal with the reality of the situation that you're confronted in. I mean, Marx would ever foresee the state that we're in now, although he could predict certain things would happen. As far as the left's being sectarian, I wrote this series up here, which I again want to draw your attention to, because I think you could get a lot out of them, because it's a progression that I can't go into in a limited amount of time. But the sectarianism, that was written for a socialist newspaper, which hadn't dealt with the environmental issue until 1990, okay? They weren't focused on that. I was primed to do that because I was in an office, a sick building, where I got environmental illness, and I became disabled from it. So that spurred me to get involved in the issue of health and what's happening to people. I wasn't the only one in the office that was sick. So that led me to see that, and the socialists did start to come around to the question of the environmental illness. The sectarianism was in being led mainly by a white male left that I felt didn't incorporate feminism and anti-racist work in the way that would have made the organizations on the left more healthy. Okay, we still have that problem. So I think I work in the women's movement, an independent women's movement, but I try to also, a lot of the leadership of the Green Party is women. And that's another reason I'm comfortable in it. So it's becoming more diverse. It used to be mainly white. It's becoming more diverse. We've recruited a lot of Latinos and Black Caucus and Afro. There's actually some Native American members that are trying to form a caucus in it. So it's a question of diversifying to get.
What about the electoral base? Have you made inroads into non-white communities? I mean, the argument has always been that they're very white in its electoral support.
Well,
sorry, to make sure we get our last question in the last few minutes, I'm going to have to interrupt.
Yes.
So one more question, and if you can just respond in 30 second to 1 minute answers or not at all. Thanks.
First of all, I want to say thank you to you guys for taking the time and coming here and for your fight to protect the environment. I think, thank you, Linda, especially, because I won't say that I do share most of your views, but I have to agree with Richard in some point. Even though capitalism has been the problem and still the problem, the issue of environmental fight, I think we do need capitalism, because I believe that the solution is in the hands of people who perhaps do not have the passion as we do, but they have the money to do what we're supposed to do, right? And that's why we need policy entrepreneurs. But in my question would have been specific. directly, because I think something that has been overlooked for a while, or perhaps hasn't been mentioned, is to me, I feel like when we talk about environmental problems, I think when we look at science, I don't really know the role that science is playing. I'm not sure if science or scientists are really helping or they're part of the problem, because from history, I've studied that most of the environmental issues, they're often at a grid level because of a different worldview between environmentalists and communicopians, and that's, to me, it's because of science. So I'm not sure with the United Front, how do we sort of unite our ideas and make them to a point where youth would be enthusiasm in continuing the fight? Because I share a lot of frustration. I feel like whatever we try to do, it's going nowhere.
So I think, consider this a closing remarks to answer this question. Thank
okay.
you.
I personally feel coalition. I've always tried to build coalitions. And while there are a lot of different organizations, I think the left has to get together in coalition form and enter the electoral arena, which gives you a tremendous audience independently. Now, people are impressed that DSA is, what they say, 50, 60,000 people now. People forget the Green Party probably has 300,000 registered voters. But we can't take advantage of that because we don't have the infrastructure and support from the left that we need. That's the key, and I'll end there.
There was a word you said that I didn't quite hear about, like science and something else, and people, the difference of, there was something I didn't quite hear. But I was gonna say that I don't think that science is a one thing in and of itself. And I began by saying, I don't think that the specific issue that we were addressing about environmental catastrophe, I don't see it as a scientific question or problem. I see it as essentially a political and social problem of how to respond to fairly well-established scientific facts. And so I don't think that you can, in the first place, talk about just science, period. I think that science is part of society and has many different effects. And again, I don't think that this particular issue is one is a problem with science. It's a problem with politics, economics, and things like that.
Yeah, I'm with both the speakers here. I think in the complete, maybe concluding mode, coalition, united front. How we can build that energy to fight? I don't know. I wish I had the answer to that. I think a lot of us wish we had the like one answer to how we can sort of fight in the face of despair. I think by remembering that they are our enemies, want us to be in despair and to be hopeless. Is an absolutely critical thing to remember. Those two concepts, coalition, united front, towards. I don't know. We'll see.
And don't forget my articles up here because.
Well, on that note, let's thank our panelists. So thank you everyone for coming.
Yes.
If you want to talk to any of us about events like this or our weekly reading group, Platypus, talk to any of us with the buttons or catch some of our literature people up front. I think some of us might go to movies to continue the conversation, which is...